This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome to The New Scientist. I'm Paul Hinkle and I'll be your reader this week. Articles this week will come from The New Scientist collection and it's a focus on mathematics. These are long form articles. The first one, As Easy as Pie. Sharing a pizza with a friend, but not sure you're getting a fair share? Stephen Orns discovers there's a guaranteed way to find out. Lunch with a colleague from work should be a time to unwind, the most taxing task being to decide what to eat, drink, and choose for dessert. For Rick Mabry and Paul Dearman, it has never been that simple. They can't think about sharing a pizza, for example, without falling headlong into the mathematics of how to slice it up. We went to lunch together at least once a week, says Mabry, recalling the early 1990s when they were both at Louisiana State University, Shreveport. One of us would bring a notebook and we'd draw pictures while our food was getting cold. The problem that bothered them was this. Supposed a harried waiter cuts the pizza off-center, but with all the edge-to-edge cuts crossing at a single point, and with the same angle between adjacent cuts. The off-center cuts mean the slices will not all be the same size, so if two people take turns to take neighboring slices, they'll get equal shares by the time they have gone right around the pizza. And if not, who will get more? Of course, you could estimate the area of each slice, total them up, and work out each person's total from that. But these guys are mathematicians, and so that wouldn't quite do. They wanted to be able to distill the problem down to a few general, provable rules that avoid exact calculations, and that work every time for any circular pizza. As with many mathematical conundrums, the answer has arrived in stages, each looking at different possible cases of the problem. The easiest example to consider is when at least one cut passes through plum through the center of the pizza. A quick sketch shows that the pieces then pair up on either side of the cut through the center and so can be divided evenly between the two diners no matter how many cuts there are. So far, so good. But what if none of the cuts passes through the center? For a pizza cut once, the answer is obvious by inspection. Whoever eats the center eats more. The case of a pizza cut twice, yielding four slices, shows the same result. The person who eats the slice that contains the center gets the bigger portion. That turns out to be an anomaly to the three general rules that deal with greater numbers of cuts, which would emerge over a subsequent years to form the complete pizza theorem. The first proposes that if you cut a pizza through the chosen point with an even number of cuts, more than two, the pizza will be divided evenly between the two diners who each take alternate slices. This side of the problem was first explored in 1967 by one L.J. Upton in Mathematics magazine. Upton didn't bother with two cuts. He asked readers to prove that in the case of four cuts, making eight slices, the diners can share the pizza equally. Next came the general solution for an even number of cuts greater than four, which first turned up as an answer to Upton's challenge in 1968, with elementary algebraic calculations of the exact area of the different slices revealing that, again, the pizza is always divided equally between the two diners. With an odd number of cuts, things start to get more complicated. Here the pizza theorem says that if you cut the pizza with 3, 7, 11, 15 cuts, and no cut goes through the center, then the person who gets a slice that includes the center of the pizza eats more in total. If you use 5, 9, 13, and 17 cuts, the person who gets the center ends with the less. Rigorously proving this to be true, however, has been a tough nut to crack. So difficult, in fact, that Mabry and Dearman have only just finished a proof that covers all possible cases. Their quest started in 1994 when Dearman showed Mabry a revised version of the pizza problem, again published in Mathematics magazine. readers were invited to prove two specific cases of the pizza theorem. First, that if a pizza is cut three times into six slices, the person who eats the slice containing the pizza's center eats more. Second, that if the pizza is cut five times, making 10 slices, the opposite is true, and the person who eats the center eats less. The first statement was posed as a teaser. It had already been proved by the authors. The second statement, however, was preceded by an asterisk, a tiny symbol which, in Mathematics Magazine, can mean big trouble. It indicates that the proposers haven't yet proved the proposition themselves. Perhaps most mathematicians would have thought, if those guys can't solve it, I'm not going to look at it, Mabry says. We were stupid enough to look at it. Diarmin quickly sketched a solution to the three-cut problem. One of the most clever things I've ever seen, as Mabry recalls. The pair went on to prove the statement for five cuts, even though new tangles emerged in the process. And then proved that if you cut the pizza seven times, you get the same result as for three cuts. The person who eats the center of the pizza ends up with more. Boosted by their success, they thought that they may have stumbled onto a technique that could prove the entire pizza theorem once and for all. For an odd number of cuts, opposing slices inevitably go to different diners. So an intuitive solution is to simply compare the sizes of opposing slices and figure out who gets more and by how much before moving on to the next pair. Working your way around the pizza pan, you total up the differences. And there's your answer. Simple enough in principle, but it turned out to be horribly difficult in practice to come up with a solution that covered all the possible number of odds cuts. Mabry and Diarmin hoped they might be able to deploy a deft geometrical trick to simplify the problem. The key was the area of the rectangular strips lying between each cut and a parallel line passing through the center of the pizza. That's because the difference in area between two opposing slices can be easily expressed in terms of areas of the rectangular strips defined by the cuts. The formula for the area of strips is easier than for slices, Mabry says. And the strips give some very nice visual proofs of certain aspects of the problem. Unfortunately, the solution still included a complicated set of sums of algebraic series involving tricky powers of trigonometric functions. The expression was ugly, and even though Mabry and Diarmin didn't have to calculate the total exactly, they still had to prove it was positive or negative to find out who gets the bigger portion. It turned out to be a massive hurdle. It ultimately took 11 years to figure that out, says Mabry. Over the following years, the pair returned occasionally to the pizza problem, but with only limited success. The breakthrough came in 2006 when Mabry was on a vacation in Kempten im Allgäu in the far south of Germany. I had a nice hotel room, a nice cool environment, and no computer, he says. I started thinking about it again, and that's when it all started working. Mabry and Diarmin, who by now was at Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau, had been using computer programs to test their results. But it wasn't until Mabry put the technology aside that he saw the problem clearly. He managed to refashion the algebra into a manageable, more elegant form. Back home, he put computer technology to work again. He suspected that someone, somewhere, must have already worked out the simple-looking sums at the heart of the new expression. So he trolled the online world for theorems in the vast field of combinatorics, an area of pure mathematics concerned with listing, counting, and rearranging, that might provide the key result he was looking for. Eventually, he found what he was after, a 1999 paper that referenced a mathematical statement from 1979. There, Mabry found the tools he and Diarmin needed to show whether the complex algebra of the rectangular strips came out positive or negative. The result of the proof then fell into place. So with the pizza theorem proved, will all kinds of important practical problems now be easier to deal with? In fact, there don't seem to be any such applications. Not that Mabry is unduly upset. It's a funny thing about some mathematicians, he says. We often don't care if the results have applications because the results are themselves so pretty. Sometimes these solutions to abstract mathematical problems do show their face in unexpected places. For example, a 19th century mathematical curiosity called the space-filling curve, a sort of early fractal curve, recently resurfaced as the model for the shape of the human genome. Mabry and Diarmuid have gone on to examine a host of other pizza-related problems. Who gets more crust, for example, and who will eat the most cheese? And what happens if the pizza is square? Equally appetizing to the mathematical mind is the question of what happens if you add extra dimensions to the pizza. A three-dimensional pizza, one might argue, is a calzone, a bread pocket filled with pizza toppings, suggesting a whole host of calzone conjectures, many of which Mabry and Diarmuid have already proved. It's a passion that has become increasingly theoretical over the years. So if you're on your next trip to a pizza joint, you see anyone scribbling formula on a napkin, it's probably not Mabry. This may ruin any pizza endorsements I ever hope to get, he says, but I don't eat much American pizza these days. Now, your second article. What's luck got to do with it? Even if you can't beat the system, there are some cunning ways to tilt the odds in your favor. Helen Thompson takes a punt. In 2004, Londoner Ashley Revell sold his house, all his possessions, and cashed in his life savings. It raised £76,840. He flew to Las Vegas, headed to the roulette table, and put it all in red. The wheel was spun. The crowd held its breath as the ball slowed, bounced four or five times, and finally settled on number seven, red seven. Revell's bet was a straight gamble, double or nothing. But when Edward Thorpe, a mathematics student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, went to the same casino some 40 years previously, he knew pretty well where the ball was going to land. He walked away with a profit, took it to the race course, the basketball court, and the stock market, and became a multimillionaire. He wasn't on a lucky streak. He was using his knowledge of mathematics to understand and beat the odds. No one can predict the future, but with powers of probability can help. Armed with this knowledge, a high school mathematics education, and £50, I headed off to find out how Thorpe and others like him have used mathematics to beat the system. Just how much money could probability make me? When Thorpe stood at the roulette wheel in the summer of 1961, there was no need for nerves. He was armed with the first wearable computer, one that could predict the outcome of the spin. Once the ball was in play, Thorpe fed the computer information about the speed and position of the ball and the wheel using a micro switch inside his shoe. It would make a forecast about a probable result, and I'd bet on neighboring numbers, he says. Thorpe's device would now be illegal in a casino, and in any case, getting a computer to do the work wasn't exactly what I had in mind. However, there is a simple and surefire way to win at the roulette table, as long as you have deep pockets and a faith in probability theory. A spin of the roulette wheel is just like the toss of a coin. Each spin is independent with a 50-50 chance of the ball landing on black or red. Contrary to intuition, a black number is just as likely to appear after a run of 20 consecutive black numbers as seemingly more likely red. The randomness means there is a way of using probability to ensure a profit. Always bet on the same color, and if you lose, double your bet on the next spin. Because your color will come up eventually, this method will always produce a profit. The downside is that you'll need a big pot of cash to stay in the game. A losing streak can escalate your bets very quickly. Seven unlucky spins on £10 starting bet will have you parting with a hefty £12,000 or £1,280 on the next. Unfortunately, your winnings don't escalate in the same way. When you do win, you will only make a profit equal to your original stake. So while the theory is sound, be careful. The roulette wheel is likely to keep on taking your money longer than you can remain solvent. With that in mind, I turned my back on roulette and followed Thorpe into the card game blackjack. In 1962, he published a book called Beat the Dealer, which proved what many had long suspected. By keeping track of the cards, you can tip the odds in your favor. He earned thousands of dollars putting his proof into practice. The method is now known as card counting. So does it still work? Could I learn to do it? And is it legal? It's certainly not illegal, Thorpe assures me. The casino can't see inside your head yet. What's more, after a brief tutorial, it doesn't sound too difficult. If you went into any casino that had basic blackjack rules, learned the method of card counting that I've taught you, you'd have a modest advantage without much effort, says Thorpe. Basic card counting is simple. Blackjack starts with each player being dealt two cards face up. Face cards count as 10 and the ace as 1 or 11 at the player's discretion. The aim is to have as high a total as possible without busting, going over 21. To win, you must achieve a score higher than the dealer's. Cards are dealt from a shoe, a box of cards made up of 3 to 6 decks. Players can stick with the two cards they are dealt or hit and receive an extra card to try to get closer to 21. If the dealer's total is 16 or less, the dealer must hit. At the end of each round, used cards are discarded. The basic idea of card counting is to keep track of those discarded cards to know what's left in the shoe. That's because a shoe rich in high cards will slightly favor you, while a shoe rich in low cards is slightly better for the dealer. With lots of high cards still to be dealt, you are more likely to score 20 or 21 with your first two cards, and the dealer is more likely to bust if its initial cards are less than 17. An abundance of low cards benefits the dealer for similar reasons. If you keep track of which cards have been dealt, you can gauge when the game is swinging in your favor. The simplest way is to start at zero and add or subtract according to the dealt cards. Add 1 when low cards, 2 to 6, appear. Subtract 1 when high cards, 10 to and above, appear. And stay put on 7, 8, and 9. Then place your bets accordingly. Bet small when your running total is low, and when your total is high, bet big. This method can earn you a positive return of up to 5% on your investment. After a bit of practice at home, I headed off to my nearest casino. Trying to blend in among the rich young things, the shady mafia types, and the glamorous cocktail waitresses was one thing. Counting cards while trying to remain calm was another. If they suspect that you're counting cards, they'll ask you to move to a different game or throw you out completely, one of the casino's regulars tell me. After a few hours, I begin to get the hang of it and eventually walk away with a profit of £12 on a total stake of £30. The theory is good, but in practice, it's a lot of effort for a small return. It would be a lot easier if I could just win the lottery. How can I improve my chances there? In it to win it. The evening of 14 January 1995 was one that Alex White will never forget. He matched all 6 numbers on the UK National Lottery with a massive estimated jackpot of £16 million. Unfortunately, White, not his real name, only won £122,000 because 132 other people also matched all 6 numbers and took a share of the jackpot. There are dozens of books that claim to improve your odds of winning the lottery. None of them works. Every combination of numbers has the same odds of winning as any other, 1 in 13,983,816 in the case of the UK's 49-ball lotto games of the time. But as White's story shows, the fact that you could have to share the jackpot suggests a way to maximize any winnings. Your chances of success may be tiny, but if you win with nobody else, if you win with numbers nobody else has chosen, you win big. So how do you choose a combination unique to you? You won't find the answer at the National Lottery headquarters. They don't give out any information about the numbers people chose. That didn't stop Simon Cox, a mathematician at the University of Southampton, UK, from trying. In the mid-1990s, a few years after the UK National Lottery had begun, Cox worked out UK Lottery Playbook's favorite figures by analyzing data from 113 lottery draws. He compared the winning numbers with how many people had matched 4, 5, or 6 of them. and thereby inferred which numbers are most popular. And what were the magic numbers? 7 was the favorite, chosen 25% more often than the least popular number of 46. Numbers 14 and 18 were also popular, while 44 and 45 were among the least favorite. The most noticeable preference was for numbers up to 31. They call this the birthday effect, says Cox. A lot of people use their date of birth. Several other patterns emerged. The most popular numbers are clustered around the center of the form people fill in to make their selection, suggesting that players are influenced by its layout. Similarly, thousands of players appear to just draw a diagonal line through a group of numbers on the form. There is also a clear dislike of consecutive numbers. People refrain from choosing numbers next to each other, even though getting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 is as likely as any other number combination, says Cox. Numerous studies in the U.S., Swiss, and Canada lotteries have produced similar findings. To test the idea that picking unpopular numbers can maximize your winnings, Cox simulated a virtual syndicate that bought 75,000 tickets each week, choosing its numbers at random. Using the real results of the first 224 and that UK lottery draws, he calculated this in this syndicate would have won a total of £7.5 million on an outlay of £16.8 million. If his syndicate had stuck to unpopular numbers, however, it would have more than doubled to his winnings. So the strategy is clear. Go for numbers above 31 and pick ones that are clumped together or situated around the edges of the form. Then if you match all the numbers, you won't have to share with dozens of others. Unfortunately, probability also predicts that you won't match all the numbers in a weekly draw for a good few centuries. Perhaps I'm best off heading for the bookmaker. Although it would be nearly impossible to beat a seasoned bookie at his own game, play two or three bookies against each other and you can come up a winner. So claims John Barrow, a professor of mathematics at the University of Cambridge, in his 2008 book, 100 Essential Things You Didn't Know You Didn't Know. Barrow explains how to hedge your cash on different bookies to ensure that whatever the outcome of the race, you make a profit. Although each bookie will stack their own odds in their favor, thus ensuring that no punter can place bets on all the runners in a race and guarantee a profit, that doesn't mean their odds will necessarily agree with those of a different bookie, says Barrow. And this is where gamblers can seize their dance. Let's say, for example, you want to bet on one of the highlights of the British sporting calendar, the annual university boat race between old rivals Oxford and Cambridge. One bookie is offering 3-1 on Cambridge to win, and 1-4 on Oxford. But a second bookie disagrees and has Cambridge even 1-1 and Oxford at 1-2. Each bookie has looked after his own back, ensuring that it is impossible for you to bet on both Oxford and Cambridge with him and make a profit regardless of the results. However, if you spread your bets between the two bookies, it is possible to guarantee success. Having done the calculations, you place 37.50 on Cambridge with bookie 1 and $100 on Oxford with rookie 2. Whatever the result, you make a profit of £12.50. Simple enough in theory, but is it a realistic situation? Yes, says Barrow. It's very possible. Bookies don't always agree with each other. Guaranteeing a win this way is known as arbitrage, but opportunities to do it are rare and fleeting. You're more likely to be able to place this kind of bet when there are the fewest possible runners in a race. Therefore, it is easier to do it at the dogs, where there are 6 in each race, than at the horses, where there are many, many more, says Barrow. Even so, the mathematics is relatively simple, so I decided to try it out online. The beauty of online betting is that you can easily find a range of bookies all offering slightly different odds on the same race. There are certain opportunities on a daily basis, says Tony Calvin of online bookie Betfair. It's not necessarily risk-free because you might not be able to get the bit you want exactly when you need it. But there are certainly people who make a living out of arbitrage. After persuading a few friends to help me try an online bet, we followed a race, each keeping track of a horse and the odds offered by various online bookies. Keeping track of the odds to spot arbitrage opportunities was hard enough. Working out what to bet and when was, unsurprisingly, even harder. Arbitrage is not for the uninitiated. Cut your losses. However, it's still quite addictive, especially when you get tantalizingly close to finding a winning combination. And that's the problem with gambling. Even when you have got mathematics on your side, it's all too easy to lose sight of what you could lose. Fortunately, that's the final thing that probability can help you with, knowing when to stop. Everything in life is a bit of a gamble. You could spend months turning down job offers because the next one might be better, or keep laying bets on the roulette table just in case you win. Knowing when to stop can be as much of an asset as knowing how to win. Once again, mathematics can help. If you have trouble knowing when to quit, try getting your head around diminishing returns, the optimal stopping tool. The best way to demonstrate diminishing returns is the so-called marriage problem. Suppose you are told you must marry and that you must choose your spouse out of 100 applicants. You may interview each applicant once. After each interview, you must decide whether to marry that person. If you decline, you lose the opportunity forever. If you work your way through 99 applicants without choosing one, you must marry the 100th. You may think you have 1 in 100 chance of marrying your ideal partner, but the truth is that you can do a lot better than that. If you interview half the potential partners, then stop at the next best one, that is, the first one better than the best person you've already interviewed, you will marry the very best candidate about 25% of the time. Once again, probability explains why. A quarter of the time, the second best partner will be in the first 50 people, and the very first in the second. So 25% of the time, the rule stop at the next best one will see you marrying the best candidate. Much of the rest of the time, you'll end up marrying the 100th person, who has a 1 in 100 chance of being the worst. But hey, this is probability, not certainty. You can do even better than 25%, however. John Gilbert and Frederick Mosteller of Harvard University proved that you could raise your odds to 37% by interviewing 37 people, then stopping at the next best. The number 37 comes from dividing 100 by E, the base of the natural logarithms, which is roughly equal to 2.72. Gilbert and Mosteller's law works no matter how many candidates there are. You simply divide the number of options by E. So, for example, suppose you find 50 companies that offer car insurance, but you have no idea whether the next quote will be better or worse than the previous one. Should you get a quote from all 50? No. Phone 18, which is 50 divided by 2.72, and go with the next quote that beats the first 18. And that's all we have time for The New Scientist. I hope you have a great week.